Having a teen feels like having your own live-in influencer. Somehow you know the latest makeup trend and the fact that skinny jeans are not the most flattering pants. Now it's time for you to show them what's up, thanks to Domino's. From April 22nd through April 28th, carry out as many large two-topping pizzas from Domino's as you want for only $6.99 each. And teach your kiddo that saving money and Domino's pizza will never go out of style. Carry out only. You must ask for this limited time offer. Valid 422 through 428. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary.
Feel like you got enough to do already? I do. That's why I use Shipt same-day delivery to keep up with my busy life. They know the snacks I like down to the extra creamy in my peanut butter. I can get deliveries at home, on set, or even when I'm away on vacay. And my personal shopper, Amber, she's got my back. As in, she asked them to check the back if it's not on the shelf. Shipt. Delight in every delivery. Learn more at shipt.com/hi.
And we are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I am the impactful Ira Madison III.
And I am Louis Vertel. And I just want to say I did something that I feel like a lot of our listeners do that I never do, which is spent the entire week binging reality TV. And I want to say it has brought me no closer to civilization. I feel like an alien. I feel like I don't know what's going on. I miss my regular life. And the show I am talking about is The Traitors. Both UK and Australia. I'm one episode away from finishing Australia. And my only takeaway from watching this much of this show is that if I ever arrive at a party late and people are playing the game Mafia, it is fun just to sit and watch the game of Mafia. That's it. I have nothing else to say about the show. Why am I watching this, watching people guess who a traitor is with no evidence and then calling it a game? It's like a bad game. If anything, it's nice to know you can make good TV out of a bad game.
Yeah. So I'm in a group text with my friend Angelina Burnett, who's been on the show before, Ray Sani, former guest host of the show. And Ray keeps apologizing to us for, quote unquote, ruining our enjoyment of the show because she's still enjoying it. But she continues to tweet every week, "This game is broken. It makes no sense. It's impossible sort of to really figure out how to win the game as a faithful, but it's still fun to watch." And I'm like, yes, I know that, but it is still fun. You're watching it for the theatrics.
Totally.
And the UK version is giving you theatrics. Baby.
Oh, yeah. No, also, like, lots of fun twists and turns in the UK version. The host of the UK is a fun, droll version of a host, Claudia Winkleman. Not as good as Ellen Cumming, who I think is bringing more campy gusto that I think the show needs. But the problem with the show is also, once the faithfuls, the good contestants, start sussing out the traitors, they eliminate them. And then after a while, the traitors then just have to add more new traitors. And then then the contestants have even less to go off of in terms of figuring out who they are. So it's just, it's not a fair game, nor does it even feel like a game. Nor do you even feel like, am I getting to the end? Like, am I doing good? There's no "I'm doing good" part of the show.
There's silly conjecture that happens too once, you know, a traitor has been recruited later into the game. When someone says, "Well, you came down to the dinner table acting different today." And it's like, no, they didn't. They're not a traitor.
Right. No, they just walked in. Yeah, right. And also, it's like everybody kind of behavior changes aren't something that would necessarily indicate somebody is a traitor. It's like there's no rubric for how to play the game or what you're actually looking for. So anyway, it's confusing and I can't stop watching.
I will say the people who seem to like have at least hacked the broken game are Sandra the most, and then also CT. Because Sandra has figured out...
We're talking about Sandra from Survivor, Sandra Diaz-Twine.
So, yes. Sandra has at least figured out, and CT from The Challenge. They're both on the current season of the US. She's at least figured out that this game is completely random, except for the traitors are always going to murder people who are either coming for them or don't have suspicion on them as traitors, so they're completely useless to them in the game to throw suspicion on.
Right.
So Sandra, in her confessionals, has revealed that if you figure out who the traitors are, then you should buddy up to the traitors so that they don't axe you when they murder people at night. And then, ideally, when you get to the end of the game is you get to split the prize money with whoever's left in the finale. But if there's one traitor in the game, then they take the whole prize pot.
Right.
Ideally, if you get to the finale and you know who a traitor has been all along and they trust you, you can then vote to banish them in the finale and not give them any money.
And right. And then win for yourself. Like you can contain the threat of a traitor by keeping them in the game.
Yes.
That said, what kind of game is that? You know who the threat is, and also just keep them around. It's just like not, right. it's not really compelling. I don't know.
Also, the lunacy of this season, because they added even more reality show people as opposed to a mix of reality show people and, you know, normies, is that they all reverted to their reality show, sort of roots of forming alliances.
Right. Yeah.
For no reason. So you have like Peter the Bachelor forming an alliance of people and then the Housewives forming an alliance and they're basically voting against one another. And it's, we're supposed to be getting out traitors here, baby.
Yeah, right.
You can't just vote out everyone who's not your friends.
And yet again, I'm still watching the damn show. So just once you get started, just know that this is going to be your life for a few weeks. You know, it's again, it reminds me of that feeling of that one Christmas when we all decided to watch Making a Murderer. And I'm like, now my Christmas is ruined. And I'm thinking about this horrible cold case. And why did I want to get into this in the first place? What was the gratifying part? Not that they're the same thing, this actual docuseries about a real murderer and the traitors, but it is just a whole bunch of hours of television leading up to, oh, I guess that was entertaining enough for me. That's like all I get out of it.
Mm. You know, I thought you were going to say that you'd been watching something like The Real World, like me, because I've been watching Real World Austin on Netflix.
Oh, no, wait, sorry. Who's on Austin season?
That is Wes's first season.
Okay,
of
yes.
Television. You have Nehemiah.
Yes.
You have Johanna. You have Danny.
Of course, of course, of course. This is like a chaotic, drunken season.
It's actually very fun, and this is a longer thing that we could talk about in another episode, but there is just something quaint about watching the show. It came out summer 2005, so this is after our freshman year of college, and there's something quaint about watching people immediately at the onset of Facebook, but they probably don't even really have it yet.
Yeah.
Just, do you remember how excited people were to be on The Real World, just to live in a house with strangers and stop acting polite, start acting real? And they're just fun, drunk college students making out with it. Two girls make out in the hot tub immediately.
Imagine.
And then they go out to the bar and get into a fight because they're just sort of buzzing off of being filmed. But social media sort of replaced all of that now.
Right. Well, also specifically about The Real World, right around that time, that's when the show became, it was already aware of itself as a legendary show. Like, and around that time, you could watch old seasons of The Real World all the time. Like, that was in the
zeitgeist constantly. On MTV.
Contestants by that point were legendary. So, and also the show is taking the post-Las Vegas turn of, now we really all are alcohol poisoning ourselves, and that counts as reality.
And lastly, you forget about the fact that before the prevalence of reality TV cameras being everywhere, like truly you could live in Idaho right now and walk outside and there's probably a reality show being filmed on your street and you wouldn't bat an eye, right?
Mm-hmm.
On this show, you forget that people used to be angry about these young college kids showing up in their cities and having cameras follow them everywhere. So people are starting fights with them at this club in Austin in the first episode because they hate that the Real World kids are in their bar.
Wow. They're like, let us have our breakfast tacos in peace. We love our lives here in Austin. We love having breakfast at a picnic table.
I remember some of the kids from the Brooklyn, the Williamsburg season or something had said that people used to make fun of them and call them posers in New York for being on The Real World. And imagine someone in Williamsburg not wanting a camera in front of them now.
Also, imagine using the word poser. It's so Ashley Simpson culture. Exactly 2004, five. Yeah.
Very anti-Avril Lavigne. She's posing.
She got that tie around her neck from Hot Topic. Oh my God, the dialogue. We were so silly.
All right, so we have a fun episode this week. Lewis and I are feuding.
Formally, yes.
We're going to discuss the new season of Feud, Capote versus the Swans. Let me tell you something. What's good for the swan?
What was that, Aesop?
It's not good for the swander.
Okay. All right. You got me that time.
Yeah. And then also, there are mysteries abound.
Two big ones.
In the world of pop culture. First of all, Rebecca Ferguson has an op.
Right.
We don't know who, but we're going to figure it out by the time this episode's over.
And also, I want to say, this is the best press that Dune 2 has gotten yet. Rebecca Ferguson being like, somebody was an asshole to me on set once, and I'm going to let America and the world solve who it is. And we're going to get into that today.
Right. The press tour has mostly been, look at how great Zendaya looks.
Right.
And of course.
You don't say. Yeah.
Which is maybe actually not the press that you want if you were anyone else in the film, because then the press is also, look how great Zendaya looks, and look at everyone else wearing COS.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody else wearing their like post-apocalyptic pseudo athleisure glamour. Yeah.
On Anya Taylor-Joy walking around looking like a foreign correspondent in the Middle East.
Right. Christiane Amanpour, Arrakis.
And then also, Kate Middleton. Where is she?
And what is she? Do we know what she sounds like? Does she have a human voice?
And will we be attacked in the YouTube comments for referring to her as Kate Middleton by royalists? Royalists are crazy people who are obsessed with the royal family and usually are not even British.
Oh, of course. Wait, what do they want you to call her? Like Duchess of Cambridge?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, it's not going to happen. It's too long. We have one Duchess and her name is Fergie Ferg.
But speaking of Feud, our guest this week is none other than Tom Hollander himself, who plays Truman Capote in the series Feud, and Capote versus Swans.
And I hope we get into just the specifics of doing that voice, because I have a confession. At work at Kimmel, we cannot stop doing the Truman Capote voice. Somebody will just throw out a question and then the three of us respond as Truman Capote. Did I mention this before?
No.
When the Super Bowl was happening, they're like, Truman, are you going to the Super Bowl? And you respond like, Kansas City, an entire city devoted to barbecue sauce. It doesn't really speak to me. It's the most fun voice. It's the most fun voice.
We're going to get some Truman Capote voice from Jimmy at the Oscars.
I certainly have pitched it. I feel like he may be passing that up. Not really an impressions guy or a song and dance guy.
I've never really seen Jimmy do a two-step.
No, Sierra is not a part of the telecast. That I can confirm.
Can you teach him the dance that got you into Juilliard?
You know, it's been years since Savion Glover had me in class. We'll see if we can get into that.
Live his dreams. It's not as hard as it may seem.
The way I bring him to funk, you won't believe it.
Yeah. Okay, that's our show, and we're going to get started. Also, listeners, I'm doing my first live comedy show, and I need you to buy tickets because they got to sell.
Oh, we'll discuss that too.
Yes, just go to iramadison.com. It's at the Music Hall of Williamsburg, March 20th at 8 p.m. And my guest is Cody Rigsby and Jay Jordan, because he's very funny, and Peyton Dix.
So I love Jay Jordan. Yes.
Yes. I mean, comedians shouldn't be that hot.
It's upsetting. No. Also, it's like it's not just hot. It's like shredded. I mean, I didn't know sinew could do that.
Like he loves the X-Men and he is an X-Men. He's Colossus.
Right. No, the kind of body that looks like you've been struck by lightning and it all went right for you.
Unlike that time Screech got struck by lightning and could just read women's thoughts.
Problematic in retrospect.
Yeah, creepy episode. Anyway, my comedy show, iramadison.com to get tickets. Do that. And we will be right back with more Keep It. got to check out What a Day's new weekend series, How We Got Here, hosted by Crooked's Aaron Ryan and Max Fisher. In their latest episode, they get to the bottom of how a little Spanish retailer named Zara changed the landscape of fast fashion and accelerated the shittiness of clothing quality. New deep dive episodes of How We Got Here drop every Saturday only on the What a Day feed.
Move over, Serial. This week, Keep It joins the ranks of true crime podcasts because we're here to solve some mysteries. First, where in the world is Kate Middleton? Spoiler, in an Audi. And who screamed at Rebecca Ferguson? Spoiler, not Tom Cruise. You know what? We don't know that for sure. I think he talks and screams, so it just feels like he would be doing that every so often. But starting with Kate Middleton, yeah, so it dawned on everybody on the internet, I guess, at the same time that we hadn't seen her in a couple of months. And then people started wondering what the deal was. And I regret to inform them that they formally said about Kate Middleton, you will not be seeing her until April because she's having some sort of abdominal surgery. Now, I...
Isn't that what they would say?
They being the deep state. Yes. So if you don't know a couple of the dates, Christmas of last year, Kate attended Christmas services at Sandringham, one of the great words, with the royal family. January 16th, she underwent a planned abdominal surgery. January 17th, the official Prince and Princess of Wales Instagram account posted, Her Royal Highness, the Princess of Wales, was admitted to the London clinic yesterday for planned abdominal surgery. The surgery was successful and is expected that she will remain in hospital for 10 to 14 days before returning home to continue her recovery. Based on the current medical advice, she is unlikely to return to public duties until after Easter. Great. And then Prince William visited the hospital. A week later, King Charles visited the hospital. And then at the last minute, Prince William canceled attending a service at Thanksgiving held in honor for King Constantine, the last king of Greece. He withdrew to a personal matter, and Kensington Palace added that Kate continues to do well. Okay, here's the thing. As much as people are speculating that it's a botched face procedure specifically, or something like a hysterectomy or a treatment for an eating disorder, it feels to me like she had, and by feels to me, I mean, I have a friend who's a doctor and this is what she said, and I'm stealing this from her. She had major colorectal surgery and maybe has something like a colostomy bag. And that's why she can't be around until after Easter. That to me feels like the most rational response.
Okay. Well, I want to talk about this, this lady reappearing, quote unquote lady appearing the other day in her car.
I'm sorry, Iris' eyes just expanded like to 11 times their normal size. It was like the gecko just flew out at me.
Okay, this was not Kate in that car.
There's a picture of Kate in the back of a car that her mom is driving, and it's very grainy, and she's wearing sunglasses, and it may be Veronica Lake. I don't know who that even is in that picture.
That is Michael Caine in Dress to Kill. Okay, honey.
She's coming to that elevator and you better watch out. There's a knife in the trench.
That is the Lucille doll that Buster was running around with in Arrested Development. Okay. That was not Kate. That was some Evelyn Salt shit.
Yeah, right. Yes. Down to the hair. Yes.
Heavy shades. Yeah. And also the photo is grainy. Who has an Android at the castle?
Right. No, it looked like it was filmed on a Sega Genesis. I mean, I just don't know who that was. Yeah.
Buckingham ain't got a family plan.
If anyone.
You're kidding me. That's a lot of bitches.
It's also so interesting because, by the way, this reminds me of, I'm so sorry, The Traitors, in that anybody can become fascinating to you if you're left with one question about them. Because, by the way, before, who has ever said anything qualitative about Kate Middleton? I saw that wedding. As I've said before, no one waves better. If someone's standing in front of a crowd, something about the curvature of her hand is ready for pageant culture. I love to see it. That's where my questions ended. I had nothing else to think about Kate Middleton. And now finally, there is a level of doubt about what she could be up to, even though, yet again, I still do not know what this woman sounds like.
Okay. Now, I will say that there was a royal who died recently.
Okay.
Thomas Kingston, the husband of Prince William's cousin, Lady Gabriella Kingston, was found dead at his parents' home in one of those Macbeth cities, Gloucestershire.
Yeah, right. Gloms.
I don't know. Yes. Something from the Scottish play. Okay. Yeah. Like you don't say those. You can't say the cities either.
Right.
Or they'll haunt you.
Specifically on a podcast. Yes.
And people believe that this man was having an affair with Kate, and William murdered him.
Oh, just walked right in, like the Jinx style. Yeah.
I mean, he could. Who's stopping him?
Not the hundreds of guards? Okay. Nobody. Never mind.
Do you stop Prince William?
You think he gets right off the polo horse and is like, "I have a murder to do."
He is the one who knocks. Politely, though.
You get bald enough and they go bad.
That is one of the rumors, that he's covering up an affair. There's rumors that she was in a coma. She still could be.
Right. But again, the picture
we
saw.
We don't know that was her.
It was giving, like, the drawing of an alien in my Trapper Keeper in sixth grade.
They could not find a courtroom artist even at 24 hours notice.
Yeah, right. No. That photograph did look like it was drawn in colored pencil. That's how grainy it is. Rose art is complicit.
Anyway, those are the rumors about Kate. There's some other much more misogynistic ones that we don't have to get into. But if you want to look them up,
drop them in the comments. You said that we didn't, and then we just nod along and have a laugh.
Yeah. But my other question is, where are Harry and Meghan at? What are they up to?
Are they still podcasting giants or whatever?
Well, remember she quit that podcast that she didn't really want to do, but now she's doing it again.
Okay.
For some reason, I guess they need the money.
I have no guess as to what's up with their finances. I also, by the way, don't understand this about half of the working entertainment world. Namely, if you're an actress from this is a detour. If you're an actress from who like mainly worked in, say, the 80s, and now it's, today, 2024, what's up with you? Did you have to marry somebody rich? Is there a certain kind of money that was made then that could be invested well and now you continue to do well? Because I'm just saying, anybody with an Oscar nomination before 1995, I'm worried about you.
You worried about Nancy Allen?
I mean, just in general, it has nothing to do with her finances, but of course.
Of course, she was a Golden Globe nominee.
Yeah, not an Oscar nominee. Yeah. I'm talking about the Mary McDonald's. I'm talking about the, Pauline Collins. Yeah.
Okay, well, Mary McDonald, she did Battlestar Galactica.
Okay. Who knows what that pays?
And Major Crimes, the spinoff of The Closer.
No, that's Mary McDonald. This is Mary McDonald, who is in Dances with Wolves.
Oh, well, I don't know. Maybe the Wolves had a payment plan.
Yeah, right.
Is she on Kevin Costner's payroll?
Because that's a good payroll to be on. Take a flight out to Wyoming or Montana or whatever he is. All they've got is time and money there.
And you know he got Whitney money, too.
That's right.
Not just money from the bodyguard. She probably left him something in the will.
You think so?
Her favorite white man, probably.
You think he was really her favorite white man?
Who else would there be?
Yeah, I'm trying to come up with a number too. I don't have an answer to that. I guess it would be Kevin Costner.
Yeah.
Clive Davis? Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Clive got his own shit, Like, Clive got his own shit. I ain't got to give Clive nothing. I ain't got to give Clive nothing, baby. Okay? Clive know how to take care of himself. That was my
Whitney. I also didn't know, Whitney is lightly Sly Stone. Okay, yeah. Little James Brown in there, yeah.
One thing about me playing the Snatch Game and RuPaul Charles' Drag Race, I will make Ru laugh.
Yeah, right.
And will I win? No. Will it make sense? No, but Ru will laugh.
That's the angle you have to take on Snatch Game. If it makes too much sense, the joy is immediately lost, or we get the joke immediately, and then we're done with it. Whereas if you just add absurdity, we're laughing at the absurdity.
Also, RuPaul's sense of humor is so blatantly obvious at this point.
Yes, right.
If you cannot make RuPaul laugh, you're not even remotely funny.
Right. Start with the class on social cues before you get to Drag Race.
Okay, I just have one more question about Harry and Meghan.
Okay.
Because you know, like, Tyler Perry is one of the godfathers.
Correct.
Of the kids. And loaned them their house in Montecito, everything, for the Oprah interview. Do you think that they sat down and watched Mea Culpa?
Ooh. I think maybe she did. No, she would make him watch, too.
He loved that black shit. Come on. He's probably seen more than her.
That's probably
true.
To be honest.
To be honest. I just want to know if they saw Trevante Rhodes and Kelly Rowland clapping cheeks, rolling around in paint.
Have you seen that
sex scene?
No.
Yes, it was my Keep It last week.
Oh, of course.
Have you seen the scene online of them having sex on a canvas, rolling around covered in paint?
Oh my God.
It's vile.
It's giving throwback to Farrah Fawcett's controversial expressionistic arc phase where she would go on Letterman and brag about painting naked.
Oh.
This used to be considered amazing in the 90s, like when celebrities would be wacky.
It was a little easy to do then, to be honest.
Right, because you needed a stunt. You know what I mean? Just like the world was very oriented around things like Dennis Rodman in a wedding dress, you know, things like that.
Yeah. All right, so Lewis, what's our second mystery?
Okay, so Rebecca Ferguson, who, as you know, is an actress, she is in the Dune film. She is in The Greatest Showman, whatever that is. I just know I can't see that, whatever that is.
She is in the Mission Impossible films as a character whose name I do not remember because that is not the important part of those films.
No, and as you know, those are written by AI. So Rebecca Ferguson was talking in an interview about how on a movie she was getting screamed at by a, quote, absolute idiot of a co-star. That is, by the way, the underrated part of this story. She's not just saying this person was mean to her. She thinks this person's an idiot. So I feel like that should get into our analysis here. And she says he was number one on the call sheet. Here are some quotes. I remember there was a moment and this human being was being so insecure and angry because this person couldn't get the scenes out. And I think I was so vulnerable and uncomfortable that I got screamed at. But because this person was number one on the call sheet, there was no safety net for me. So no one had my back and I would cry walking off set. This person would say things to her like, you call yourself an actor and this is what I have to work with in front of the film's crew. I just stood there breaking, she remembered. The next day she told the individual to get off my set. She recalled being so scared of the confrontation. I looked at this person and said, you can F off. I'm going to work towards a tennis ball. I never want to see you again. And then I remember the producers came up and said, you can't do this to number one. We have to let this person be on set. Ferguson says she requested to act to the back of the co-star's head. And I did, she said. I thought it shouldn't have to be that way. And I remember going to the director afterward and saying, what is happening? The director said, you're right. I am not taking care of everyone else. I'm trying to fluff this person because it's so unstable. And it was great from that moment, but it took so long for me to get to that. You know what's interesting is a lot of the people that are being tossed around in this rumor mill, she then went on in like junket interviews and seemed to be sort of friendly with all of them. She's perfectly friendly sitting alongside Jake Gyllenhaal, who this is rumored to be about. They were in a movie called Life. Another one is Michael Fassbender. They had a very friendly rapport in interviews after their movie. But a lot of people are now also saying Hugh Grant, who I don't believe has been nice one time on a set.
Now, here's something that I have to say.
Okay.
She said that it is not Tom Cruise, my king.
I'm going to say, it would be so awkward if you cried on the podcast.
He would never yell at a woman on set, okay? He would be complicit in their years-long disappearance, but...
Nazanin Boniadi, come on, keep it.
Yelling is just rude.
Yeah.
That's Shelley's real name?
Yeah. We did hear that one time when Tom was mad at other people for not complying with COVID protocols. But I feel like his yelling would be all business. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you know he sent them a cake afterwards.
Right. And he remembers them on all of their birthdays. He's one of those creepy people.
Yeah. She also said it was not Hugh Jackman. And let me tell you something. Hugh Jackman isn't yelling at women.
Right.
Not in that way.
No. He's giggling so hard he screamed. That's it. He's Australian. They don't have that kind of rage there. Unless, of course, you're Judy Davis.
Yeah, he's just doing his Boy from Oz wiggle.
Yeah,
And having a laugh with the gals.
Sure.
Okay?
A good time Australian, yes.
Yeah. And now people also suspect that it is not Dwayne The Rock Johnson because he came out in support of her for sharing, you know, her journey of being yelled at on set. And what I would like to posit is, if you were the person who yelled at Rebecca Ferguson, would it not make sense for you to publicly support her in talking about the mystery co-star? Because she's not going to respond.
I mean, I love that.
It was you.
You know who would do that? Kim Cattrall. You know, she would get right in the Instagram comments. But she's a rare kind of celebrity in that way.
Yeah.
No, you're right. That is smart to get out ahead of it. And The Rock has got some, he's like a three steps ahead guy.
He's a wrestler, okay? And let's not forget that he maybe still sort of has aspirations of going into politics.
Sure.
So I would buy a little bit of, smoke and mirrors, a little bit of traitor's behavior, if you will.
The theme of this episode, yes.
Everyone's a traitor.
I have to say, the movie that Hugh Grant and Rebecca Ferguson were in together is Florence Foster Jenkins. Where this theory falls apart is that obviously Hugh Grant is not number one on the call sheet. Meryl Streep is Florence Foster Jenkins. Yeah. He played, Foster. But also, calling someone an absolute idiot. I feel like that's an interesting thing to call Hugh Grant, other than maybe he's so dismissive of all his co-stars that you could call that idiotic behavior. But he also is clearly, kind of a literary guy. And by that, I mean just British. And I don't know that I can picture her calling him an idiot unless he was just so venomous. I don't know.
Okay. So I've gone into the Reddit threads.
Thank you.
I usually brought your snorkel. Only want to do. I usually only want to do that when I want to find the address of my local KKK chapter. But okay,
<It's> local.
No out of towners.
Yeah, right.
Okay,
just the townies. Yeah.
No new clans.
Yeah, right.
So, in terms of Hercules, Dwayne Johnson, that's the movie they did together.
Uh-huh.
You could see them acting together in multiple scenes. She was very specific that she refused to act face-to-face with this person. And they've been friendly a bit on the press tour. Jake Gyllenhaal, they seem to also be sort of chummy with one another.
Right.
Fassbender did an entire press tour together. Can't be Hemsworth.
Again, I'm just ruling out the continent of Australia. You know that about me. Okay.
Yes. Ewan McGregor, Dr. Sleep. There's a possibility that it's him, but I just don't buy that from Ewan McGregor. I feel like we would have heard that from other actors.
Right, right, right. I do feel like maybe doesn't work as much sort of in an A-listy way as I would expect someone like Ewan McGregor to work. And again, when Juliette Binoche was here, I mean, she had still had the trauma in her eyes from Jeremy Irons. And then that answered all my questions about why he's not in every project of all time.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we do say it's Hugh Grant, there is something about the fact that she never talks about Hugh Grant. And this person on Reddit said that they watched multiple interviews.
Hmm.
And maybe they shared more scenes together in Florence Foster and the Jenkins, and they were cut because of the feud between both of them.
Wow. This is a real clue in the mystery. Florence Foster Jenkins. Take that, bitch.
So what we really need is just Rebecca Ferguson to come on down and tell us who it is, girl.
And by
Give
the way,
us the tea.
Do you know what is also the tea? She is such a good actress. I love Rebecca Ferguson. Ready for way more of her. Ready for her to top line.
Yes, I'm ready for a definitive Rebecca Ferguson role.
Like, she definitely was the best part of The Greatest Showman. And is wonderful in the Dune movies, too.
She was the what now?
Are you a Timmy defender?
The Greatest Showman?
Oh, you wait. You love The Greatest Showman?
Baby. Baby, we could reach for stars. Zendaya? Zac Efron? Come on. That's Disney excellence.
Okay. Yeah, no, I guess. Yeah. I'm Team Efron. I thought the Iron Claw, I'm with like the losers on Twitter who are like, it was snubbed.
Never did I ever think you would besmirch the musical talents of Bench Pasek.
Who you can see on Tinder sometimes.
Oh, you know, my Tinder bio is asleep now.
Oh, yeah.
I keep getting emails from Tinder where it's like, your profile has been hidden because I don't use it anymore. But I'd swipe for a composer.
To be a part of the young Oscars cognoscenti, what a pleasure that would be.
And, you know, I'm looking to star in a musical, actually. So,
Is that what this Ira stand-up shit is all about? You're like, you're trying to like vault from, I assume, this black box theater in the little middle of nowhere to wherever you want to go?
Yeah, I'm trying to vault into vaudeville.
Ah, vaudeville. I love when people say vaudeville, like they're from 1928.
That's how I pronounce Villeneuve's name.
Right. I'm still not clear if I'm getting that right. Villeneuve sounds fine to me.
I really just want him to be Cuban.
Denis, I want to be in the show. Yeah. Okay, right, so we're settling with Hugh Grant. We're settling with colorectal surgery. Okay, detective.
You're settling with Hugh Grant. Okay. You're settling with Hugh Grant. I still think The Rock.
I would love for him to be dastardly, because that would be a fucking long-ass con. He's so, like, throwing his arms up, be like, who wants pizza? That's his whole vibe.
Man, Hillary Clinton wouldn't want to be in her shoes right now. He's coming for that presidency.
Right.
And you know she's running again. She didn't buy those cross trainers for nothing.
By the way, I hope everybody voted in California yesterday.
I do hope everyone voted in California yesterday, too, because, you know, Taylor Swift told everyone to. You know, she wrote, today, March 5th, is the presidential primary in Tennessee and 16 other states and territories. I wanted to remind you guys to vote the people who represent you, all caps, into power. If you haven't already, make a plan to vote today. Whether you're in Tennessee or somewhere else in the U.S., check your polling places and times at vote.org. Isn't that a lovely, beautiful statement that will not make anyone sell 200,000 less albums than they were intending to?
Right. So I want to vote for somebody that represents me, exclamation point, single 2019. Okay.
What if I want to vote for Girlicious?
That's on you.
Write in ballot.
Right.
They represent me. Yeah, I am always looking to put Robin Anton into more power.
Oh, so, God. The 2007 was such a good time for all of us.
All right, when we are back, we are joined by Truman Capote himself, Tom Hollander. Keep It is brought to you by Barefoot Dreams. Lewis?
Yes?
When you see footprints in the sand, that was when I carried you in my Barefoot Dreams robe.
Now, is that a Leona Lewis song? No?
If you want to bring coziness into your life, you turn to Barefoot Dreams, especially now as the brand is celebrating their 30th anniversary. With those 30 years of coziness, Barefoot Dreams celebrates being the originators of everyone's favorite luxe home blanket. And while many have attempted to duplicate their blankets, robes, and more, Barefoot Dreams' fabrication and quality cannot be replicated, so don't believe the dupes. Girl, this blanket is it.
I effing love this blanket. I'm thinking about it right now, and I want to jump in my bed, which is sponsored by something that we'll do another ad for momentarily. Get ready. There's a reason why Barefoot Dreams has been on Oprah's favorite things list 6 times. Jesus, get a life, Oprah. My God. Dressing head to toe in Barefoot Dreams is the key to comfort, as their collection of ultra-soft robes, Loungewear and accessories are made with premium materials. Their products make the perfect gifts, too. I throw this thing on. I wear it like a shawl. I look exactly like Ellen Burstyn. And I am the coziest a human being can be. Because, by the way, it's still that time in Los Angeles where it's, like, pretty mild outside, and then your apartment is cold. I can't explain it. I don't know things like basic science. For Keep It listeners, you can get 15% off your first purchase at barefootdreams.com with the code KEEPIT15. Don't miss out on Barefoot Dreams' soft, soothing fabrics that will bring luxury to your life.
Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account of what it means to be black today, told from a unique black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story, but now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that cater black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR wherever you get your podcasts. Keep It is brought to you by Factor. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delish, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Really, that rat from Ratatouille is just cooking it.
Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. I have used Factor for years. I am literally about to go home and eat Factor meals. I love it. As you know, my cooking ability is nil, and it's going to stay that way. Yes, it's good, nutritious food. I would say it's largely responsible for my, shall we say, glow up over the past few years. So I have to credit them for just the way I live, generally speaking.
And keep your listeners know what you're talking about. They've seen the glow up.
Follow my Patreon for more. Factor's ready-to-eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. Eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff. Customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. They're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals.
Head to factormeals.com/keepit50 and use code KEEPIT50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. That's code KEEPIT50 at factormeals.com/keepit50. 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Lauryn Hill, X Factor. Louis Vertel, Active Factor.
Okay. You just miseducated me.
Our guest this week has been charming us on screen for years in the likes of Gosford Park, Pride and Prejudice, Pirates of the Caribbean, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, and The Night Manager. But he's really made a splash recently with iconic performances in The White Lotus Season 2 and now Feud, Capote versus the Swans. He's a BAFTA winner, a Tony nominee, and now that he's on Keep It, it's his turn to say, "These gays are trying to kill me." So please welcome to Keep It, Tom Hollander.
Thanks, Ira. Thank you very much. Thrilled to be here. Thrilled. And thanks for that intro.
Now, okay, in reading about your preparation to play Truman Capote, where apparently you're like wandering around a park, doing the voice to yourself, listening to tapes of Truman Capote, and it seemed like a months-long process to get into this character. Was it at all a joyous experience, or was it just a massive undertaking? Because he's such a specific character with a specific type of voice, and I feel like there's a precision that an actor like yourself would be obsessed with obtaining.
Well, you're right. I mean, the first question is, it was not, it was a joy after the end. I was nervous. The becoming him went from being a burdensome, scary thing. Am I doing it well enough? Will I get fired? I don't seem to have got fired. Oh, it's I'm relaxing. And now, and then by the end of the 6 months, he's like my friend, my sort of other, if you play a really wonderful, complicated part for a long time in its working, it does become your best mate. And so then your, and also your second life, your avatar person and your alter ego, all of those things. So you're able to express bits of yourself. First of all, you start with the burden of trying to become someone else. And then by the end of it, after 6 months, this was every day mostly, then you are expressing yourself through the character, but it gives you a freedom, and then you feel like you've developed wings or something, and you're able to do things that you couldn't do in your own life. Just like when you have a dream and you can fly, you know, that feeling that you supersede the limits of your own reality. Actors can do that when they're playing a part and not just on green screen. You know, if you're being somebody you couldn't possibly be in real life, but you can in fiction. Is that answer long and rambling enough?
No, I loved it. It was also like a poem. It was exciting to hear.
I recently read you in an interview magazine where you talked about working with Gus Van Sant as a director. And you said that he made you a bit nervous at the beginning because he doesn't say very much. But by the end of it, you love the creative freedom he gave you. But Gus recently did an interview as well where he discussed sort of his directing style, sort of in comparison to intense directors like Bertolucci. And he said that I'm really afraid of going to lots of places. I'm timid about going too far or being too intense. I try to let the actors lead if it's a hard scene. So does hearing him say that maybe inform your experience of working with him, or does it maybe change anything about how you felt during the process?
No, well, I'm initially thrilled that it seems to at least be consistent with what I said. I mean, that's the... or at least there's certainly experience I had with him. I didn't know. It's interesting. That is new information that he's scared to go there. I mean, I don't know why he would say he was scared to go there. Then I don't think he would be scared. I think he would feel it's not him. That's just not his process. So being a director is obviously very, very personal. The individual direction styles are defined by the personalities of the people who are that individual director. So Gus does not control the room by being an alpha person. I didn't see someone who's scared to go there. I saw someone who had the courage to be quiet, had the nerve to go, I don't have to control every last little bit of this. In fact, I'll get the best out of people if I just give them freedom. So there are two, you know, those are very different approaches. I have not worked with many of the so-called greats. I did actually meet Bertolucci once, but I've certainly never worked with him as an actor, but I suppose the famous film directors that I have worked with, one would be Gus Van Sant. So he as described, he looks at it like a painter looks at a canvas and is just watching the light falling on people's faces and trying to work out what the narrative is in the thing that he's looking at, and then filming it and then putting the camera in the right place. The other great that I think I worked with, an acknowledged... There are lots of greats who aren't acknowledged, but an acknowledged great was Robert Altman. Mm-hmm. I was very, very lucky to be in Gosford Park. And he similarly did not, he wore his authority so lightly, you'd think he wasn't even taking it seriously. You'd go, what are we doing in this scene? And you go, I don't know. Tom, I don't know. I mean, see how it goes. It could be terrible. You'll have a go. We'll see how it is. And then he'd invite all the actors to watch the rushes in his tent. He had a tent in front of the location where at lunchtime anyone was invited to go in and watch the rushes. So that's a director who's giving away his authority. He's not jealously hiding the rushes from anyone else so that he can edit out the terrible bits before he, you know, before anyone sees them. He's literally inviting the whole crew and the cast to come and watch whatever they did the last few days and smoking marijuana while you're doing it. So there was a kind of, it was Cheech and Chong levels of clouds coming out of this tent, and you'd be, and inside would be the legend Robert Altman and some and Maggie Smith, you know, going, I think it's quite good.
Oh my God, what a dream.
Two. Maybe I've just worked with two. I just worked with two hippies. That's all we're saying. Really.
Now, does that style work for like every actor? First of all, I'm thinking of Gosford Park, and so much is going on in any given scene. Interactions behind interactions. You know, tons of characters walking in and out. It feels crazy that he could be that lax. But like, is that a directing style that works for you? Like, if not, is there an ideal directing style you prefer?
No, I definitely don't have an ideal directing style. Absolutely not. That would be crazy. Because as an actor, what you have to do is you have to be so adaptable. That's the joy of it, is that you go into a different adventure, a different reality every job you do. Not only the part and the story obviously are different, but so is the chemistry of the group of people. So no, you don't want to go, I need this always. You get a few tricks. So I like to, now I'm old enough to have the confidence to say, can you leave me alone for three takes before you give me a note? I'm able to say that because I reckon my own imagination's got some stuff to get out of its system, and I can generally get it out in three takes. I mean, basically what I'm saying is I'll do a fast one and a slow one, and that's two. And then a third one where I just sort of see what happens. But mostly the director is a different director depending on their material. Every time they go to work, they're a slightly different person. And to characterize either Gus or Robert Altman as a doing nothing is, of course, naive and reductive, because what they're actually doing is they're watching intensely, and they're editing in their heads, and they're thinking about the whole thing. It's not all about the actor and how the actor's feeling. It's about, you know, where the camera is. So, and they're also in, you could say they're exercising control by a form of sort of passive control, by everyone steps up because nobody's saying anything. I better do my best. I'll do something. Everyone, or they're creating a level of anxiety, which is quite creative. So if everyone's feeling fabulous because they've been told they're marvelous or they think they know what's going on, that might make them kind of relax in a way that's not productive. Whereas if you say nothing and everyone's slightly on edge, maybe something interesting will happen out of anxiety, out of the need to fill the space. So it's a complicated old thing. There's a lot of, so in a way it's not mind games, but it's the difference of, it is about personalities interacting with each other. And that creates a kind of creative energy, which sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. So, but you have to, Gus has very kind eyes, and occasionally you'd see them, and you'd go, oh, that's where it is. That's where I get my little Scooby snack of encouragement. I get it from Gus's kind eyes. I don't get him coming up and going, you were darling. That was fabulous, which some directors do. Not in that voice. British directors. And they're all dead.
Yeah.
Darling, that was absolutely brilliant. Nobody speaks like that anymore.
I miss that.
Yeah, nobody does that.
Well, then I have to sort of ask about the directing style of someone like Armando Iannucci, then, working in The Loop.
Oh, yeah.
which I love, and rewatched it recently. And I have to imagine that type of film, you know, with that rapid fire comedy and everything that just sort of has to go from scene to scene, that directing style might be a little bit different.
Yes. Yes, and that's very interesting. And Armando is in his own way a complete genius. It's a different sort of thing. He's not a, I would not describe him, though I'm sure he could become one, but thus far his filmmaking has not so much been about, it's not been the painterly sort of sensual thing that Gus can do, or his is about the words, isn't it? It's about wit, certainly in The Loop. In The Loop, was there was no fancy film lighting, and In The Loop it was sort of strip lighting, it was mall lighting, in these horrible rooms that politicians spend their lives in, or they're certainly doing that in that environment. Tacky, you know, tacky walls which wobble when you push against them. That was about the wit and about the satire and constantly riffing on new ideas. So he had a similar sort of, there was a certain Devil May Care thing with his material, because he would constantly add to it. So you were, you do the script. His, what was unique about that process for me was that you would do the script, you would do the scripted version, and then you'd get that in the can, and then they would abandon the scripted version, and then you would play the scene again. The actors would be encouraged to play the scene again without using any of the scripted lines, say anything they want, but just stay in the plot of the scene. So describe the scene in your own way, as it were. Get the plot beats in as best you can, but say your own words, in the hope that somebody would say something funny and good, you know, which occasionally they did. And even if they didn't, there would be a minute or a millisecond in it, which was completely spontaneous and unprepared and so completely compelling. And what that meant was that Armando, that process gave them the motherfucker of an edit. That was the thing with that one. They went on for months and months and months, finding the little bit, the little bit, the little bit. And also, they had two cameras running around who were moving around all the time. You were never hitting marks. There were two guys with cameras on their shoulders, which I think they then used in Veep and possibly even in Succession. I'm not sure. But they would occasionally, you know, they'd be moving around. The camera people were like other actors in this on the set, so they would have to not film each other. They were trying to get the action and also keep out of each other's shot, because they'd be shooting across each other at the same time. So you can imagine the edit was kind of, there was a lot of stuff they couldn't use and a lot of stuff that was amazing, and then they had this template each time of the actual scripted scene, which we had got in the can at some stage. And on top of that, there was a team of writers sitting on the set every day, chucking in even funnier lines, which they thought of, you know, that minute. When, why don't you say that? And then you get, why don't you just say that? On that line, just say that. So it was kind of free. It was very free in a way, and took, all of this stuff takes great nerve, doesn't it? You can, I'm listening to what I'm telling you and thinking, wow, there's some balls of steel in there. To just let it go like that in the faith that you're going to get something good. But and then months and months and months of snipping it around in the edit.
Even just counting, first of all, Gosford Park, and then also Pride and Prejudice, and of course now also Feud, you have just been surrounded by these unbelievable actress performances. And yeah. I was wondering if you had a favorite one to witness on set.
Well, Olivia Colman in... I used to do a sitcom called Rev in the UK, and Olivia, we played opposite each other, and she was my wife. And there was one speech that she did. This was before Olivia had become as famous as she is now. So she was becoming Olivia Colman, and we were lucky enough to get her in this show just before she sort of went pop. But she had one speech which was in which she had to describe her sexual fantasies, and someone had written a pretty good sexual fantasy sort of list of sexual fantasies that a sort of middle-aged housewife might have, none of which were going to be fulfilled, which then led to a comic episode in which, and bear in mind, this was a priest and his wife, in which they tried to enact their sexual fantasies. None of all of, you know, it was very, it was actually quite funny. But she delivered this speech so brilliantly, so quickly, so brilliantly, with so little, so apparently effortlessly, with so much nuance and flavor in it, but all thrown away, apparently thrown away, no effort, no sweat. It was just astonishing. And I thought, and I sweated, because I realized that I was acting with someone who was really, really brilliant and quite possibly better than I was. And there was a, and so then I was thinking, wow, that's good. I couldn't do that. And then you go, but I actually think all the best actors are probably women. Certainly the ones I've met. And then the ones where you go, wow, that's just otherworldly level of emotional expression. I can't. With the guys, I'm always kind of going, yeah, I can see what you're doing. It's sort of with the ladies, you're going, wow. To do something to do with, I don't know what, but the most emotionally eloquent stuff, the most emotionally complex and sort of nuanced stuff I've seen with the female actors that I've been lucky enough to work with. Jennifer Coolidge has obviously got to be up there, because what she's doing is amazing. And standing next to that was amazing. And there's a whole bunch of them. Yeah. I mean, what was Kristin Scott Thomas doing in Gosford Park?
She is amazing in that movie. Oh, she's so, and she looks so fabulous too.
When she says, there's a couple of scenes where she's looking out of the front saying goodbye. At the, I think the very end, she says goodbye to people and it's almost wordless, and the last car drives away and you see her just sort of bottling her feelings and stepping back inside. It's amazing. It's amazing. So, I mean, I there are probably some more that you've got in mind that I now can't think of, but they're I've been, and obviously in feud for, are we allowed to say the F word on
you
this
can.
Podcast?
Yeah.
On feud, for fuck's sake. It was, look at them. You know, I mean, we're going through decades of kind of film icon status from Jessica Lange, you know, and then we're going Jessica Lange, Demi Moore, Molly Ringwald. I mean, who you know, we're going through the Brat Pack. Then we're going into 90s New York cool with Chloe Sevigny and Naomi Watts. Who have I missed out? Diane Lane, for goodness sake, who was on the cover of Time magazine when she was 12 years old. These people are all magnificent in their own right. And there was I acting with all of them. Callista Flockhart, who's one of the cleverest, wittiest, most mysterious people I've ever met. And finally, there's an actor in Feud called Ella Beatty, who was her first job. And when she did her first scene, so her first job out of Juilliard, she did her first scene all nervous, all kind of elbows and thumbs off on the set. And then on screen, I looked around the monitor and thought, oh, wow, that's amazing. Look at her. She just knows all these things already that I didn't understand about cameras and how to be in front of a camera. She seems to know them instinctively. It took me about, well, I still don't know them. I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to do what she was doing. I looked around and Gus Van Sant was, there was a tear on Gus Van Sant's cheek because she was so good straight away. It was like seeing, anyway. So there was several generations, and the new generation seemed to be in that show.
Yeah, Warren and Annette are good parents to have, I feel like, if you're interested in acting. You know what I'm saying?
I was trying to make, about her without referencing her parents, because that just reduces her to...
True.
It doesn't just...
Of course.
Of course she's Warren Beatty and Annette Bening's child, but, you know, that's no guarantee of someone being good. I mean, what if she's actually better than her parents? You know, that's what I was wondering as I looked at her. I thought, wow, she might be better than Warren. I mean, this is... It's like, it doesn't always happen. Lightning doesn't always strike in the same gene pool. Of course she's, you know, some sort of, there's a Napa baby joke to be made, but she has every, she's born to be doing what she's doing.
We're very pro Nepo babies over here. I mean, Jane Fonda's the greatest one.
Yes, Angelica Houston, please. We can go on and on. Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here with us, Tom. Honestly, your portrayal of Truman is so fun and fascinating to watch. It's been fun watching people. I've been reading like Reddit and YouTube comments of even scenes, and it's been interesting seeing people comment just about Truman Capote as a person, saying things like, I've always hated that man. I think he's disgusting, but this is a really great portrayal of him, and it's humanizing him for me. I didn't know people had that many thoughts about Truman Capote in the modern day era, people who would comment on YouTube. So you're bringing that out of people. So thank you.
I'm just part of a team. I'm lucky that I was the lucky guy that got to play Truman Capote. But it's fascinating that the show has brought him back as a figure. I didn't really understand how important he was in the sort of as a cultural figure in late 20th century American popular culture. I didn't really understand that until we did it. And I think Ryan and Gus and Robbie Bass, they all did understand that. Obviously they did. And somehow they've brought him back for people, and God bless him, because I think he had a really, really pretty miserable time a lot of the time.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Good to meet you. Thanks for having me on. Bye-bye.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Pod Save America is brought to you by Helix. If you're looking for better sleep, you need to upgrade your mattress with Helix. The Helix lineup offers 20 unique mattresses, including the award-winning Lux Collection, the newly released and high-end Helix Elite Collection, a mattress designed for big and tall sleepers, and even a mattress made just for kids, which Charlie has. Charlie has a Helix mattress now, just for kids, in his race car bed. Very excited, very happy about it. Take the Helix Sleep Quiz and find your perfect mattress in under 2 minutes, and it ships straight to your door free of charge. They even offer a 100-night trial and a 10 to 15-year warranty to try out your new Helix mattress. If you're a side sleeper, you can choose a model with memory foam layers to provide optimal pressure relief. There are also models with more responsive foam to cradle your body for essential support in stomach and back sleeping positions. Plus, check out enhanced cooling features to keep you from overheating while you sleep. It's no wonder Helix has over 12,000 five-star reviews. And you've loved your Helix mattress.
I got a Don Lux.
There you go.
And
there you go.
It's great.
Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/crooked. That's helixsleep.com/crooked. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
We'll be right back.
Okay, so you've just listened to our conversation with Tom Hollander, who portrays Truman Capote in Feud, Capote versus the Swans, the latest season of Feud, aka White Women Acting,
yes,
from Ryan Murphy. This, of course, has been written by John Robin Bates and directed largely by Gus Van Sant.
Mm-hmm.
A couple episodes are not. Do you know one of them was directed by David Lynch's daughter?
Get out! Which is interesting because there's another Nepo situation in the show, right? It's Warren Beatty and Annette Bening's daughter, Ella Beatty, is, which sounds like a pun or a Carmen Sandiego villain or something. And later in the show.
Speaking of Jennifer Lynch, have you ever seen Boxing Helena?
Not close to the time it came out, which is to say, I mean, like, it's a 90s movie. I probably saw it in like 2001 or something.
Baby, they dragged the hell out of that movie.
Yeah.
her directorial dreams were squashed.
Yeah, they were like, that's enough.
And actually, though, when you think about that film, it's very proto The Skin I Live In.
Right, 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 right. No, yes, I would say it's ahead of its time. And also definitively 90s, just the scale of the movie, the grossness of the movie. Anyway, here's my question about Truman Capote. In the era of Truman Capote, would you have been friends with Truman Capote? In what capacity would you mix it up with him? And I ask this question because once upon a time, I probably had no opinion on how gay celebrities live their lives. Now, the most suspicious thing about a gay celebrity is if we have no mutual friends. Like, I'm out in the world participating in it, being gay. There's only like 6 gay places you can go on any given night in any given city. It's inevitable that you're going to run into most people. If you don't have any mutual friends in common with me, what are you doing with your life? You can't just be working on, quote unquote, your art.
That's fair. Well, I think that I probably would be on friendly terms with him. I don't know if we'd be best friends. I don't even know if we'd be hanging out. He seemed more interested in hanging out with the Swans, to be honest.
It is definitely a specific personality type among gay men who, like, their whole thing is tons and tons of female friends, you know, which, I mean, like, you know who comes to mind immediately? Our mutual friend Sam Lansky, who I guess worked on RuPaul's new memoir too, and ghost wrote Britney Spears' memoir, works for Time Magazine.
He loves the sisters.
Yes, yes, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
And also particularly interested, seemingly, in, like, you know, name personalities.
Yes. If I'm talking about this current time and imagining, you know, my life now and Truman Capote being in New York, I would have interacted with him. I would not be at the Black and White Ball for sure.
Right. Well, you're not Candy Bergen. That's just the truth of it.
Have you ever looked at just like the list of the people who were at the Black and White Ball?
Oh, no. Please hit me with it.
The partial guest list, here's a few of the people. Lauren Bacall.
Of course.
Tallulah Bankhead.
That is actually fucking crazy because you would have thought, you know, lung cancer would have kicked her ass by that point. But no. Nobody smoked like her.
Marissa Berenson.
She's in Cabaret. Her sister, Barry Berenson, was married to Anthony Perkins.
Yeah. Also, her grandmother was Elsa Schiaparelli.
Correct. Yes. The founder of the color Shocking Pink and just fashion god. Yes.
Candace Bergen, of course, as we said. By the way, that bitch was 20.
Right.
Very. The time.
And of course, she was famous because she was a bit of a model and her dad is Edgar Bergen, the ventriloquist. But she was just beginning her movie career around then. She's in a movie called The Group, which is based off the Mary McCarthy novel about a bunch of women at Vassar, where she is simply stunning.
They hate Oleana.
Oh, my God. I hate when we bring up Oleana. It's the worst mammoth shit ever. Go on.
Richard Brooks.
Okay.
Johnny Carson and his wife, Joanne.
That character, no, that's a character on Feud played by Molly Ringwald.
Mm-hmm. Mia Farrow.
By the way, what's she up to recently?
Still Googling Black Daughter.
Yeah. Tweeting at people and stuff. Yeah.
Henry Fonda. Joan Fontaine.
Now that's Joan Fontaine. I mean, that sounds like an old world celebrity, but she lived till about 2011 or something, so she was only just beginning.
Speaking of Henry Fonda, this is weird, soapy, you know, actor sleeping with actor connections. You know, his first wife, Margaret Sullivan, who he did not have kids with, after being married to Henry, two husbands later, she was married to Leland Hayward, who divorced Slim Hayward, one of Capote's swans. So what you need to know is that at the black and white ball, there are all these people mixing sort of with their exes or exes of their exes.
Margaret Sullivan died at the age of 50 of a questionable overdose, but she's an Oscar nominee. She was in a movie called Three Comrades, in which she is fabulous. One of the first sort of deadpan actress nominations. And she's also in the classic Shop Around the Corner. If you haven't seen that, you must see the Shop Around the Corner.
Mm. Arlene Francis.
Oh my God. One of my favorite celebrities of all time. What's my line, panelist? I always say that she's the secret inspiration for Carol in the movie Carol, because that performance reminds me of her. I'm fully tin-hatted in this way.
Let's see. Irving Paul Lazar. He was a talent agent. Joshua Logan.
Oh, he was a director, and he directed Jane Fonda and Anthony Perkins together in a movie called Tall Story, which was her debut, 1959, or into 1960. And she claims that the set was fraught because she had a crush on Anthony Perkins, and so did he. And he's never been confirmed as gay. And so Jane's just out here spilling tea.
Well, he co-wrote South Pacific, so.
Oh, keep it faggoty, huh? Wow. He wants to wash that man right into his hair. You know what I'm saying?
Joe Mankiewicz.
There's like 50 of them.
Yeah. Vincent Minnelli.
Aha. I think still to date, the only trio of people where it's husband, wife, and daughter all have an Oscar. I think that's the only configuration where that's true. I'm just spouting facts now. Phyllis Newman was also a What's My Line panelist, specifically after Dorothy Kilgallen passed away. That's a very fascinating story. But what you need to know about Phyllis Newman is she's the reason Barbra Streisand doesn't have a competitive Tony, because she beat her in I Can Get It For You Wholesale, which is sort of one of the definitive supporting turns ever on Broadway, the one Barbra probably should have won for. She didn't win for Funny Girl because she lost to Carol Channing. But Phyllis Newman is the reason she lost.
Mm. We also had Harold Prince.
Broadway's own.
And Mr. Zanuck himself.
Come on, moviedom.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Also, Sammy Davis Jr. was there. A black person. And Ralph Ellison.
That's a get. Ralph Ellison, because yes. He was like, he did his one work, and then he's like, well, that's the end of me.
Yeah, when you look down under the writers and artists section, you've basically got Lillian Hellman, Christopher Isherwood, Norman Mailer, Arthur Miller, Oscar De La Renta, Jerome Robbins, Frank Sinatra, Stephen Sondheim was there. John Steinbeck was there.
I'm going to say quickly about Lillian Hellman, one of the great liars of all time. She, first of all, was in a longtime feud with Mary McCarthy, who I just brought up, who wrote that The Group that became a movie with Candace Bergen. But Lillian Hellman is the source of inspiration for the movie Julia in the late 70s that Jane Fonda was the star of. She was nominated for an Oscar for it. And the entire story of how she was friends with this woman, who in the movie is played by Vanessa Redgrave, and she goes off to war, but they have this lifelong friendship, is totally debunked. Lillian Hellman lied about this story, and it was proven again and again. It's like you know this Flamin' Hot movie about Doritos that turned out to be not true? It's one of these few movies in Oscar history that is supposed to be compelling real-life drama, and it is totally fabricated.
Okay, I need to watch that.
Yes.
For one. And two, that is also probably why I say that I would at least know of Truman Capote, because he was a writer. And looking at this list of people at the black and white ball, it is just fun thinking of that era where the most fabulous party that everyone wanted to get into in New York was thrown by a writer.
Yeah,
and there were other writers there, and you were famous for writing. back then.
Right. And you had some enigma about you because, you know, maybe you got to appear on something like Dick Cavett or something. But for the most part, writers had a sort of sequestered glamour about them. Whereas now we just think of them as desperate people waiting for a gig.
Right. I forget the exact quote, but when I was looking up things about Truman Capote, I believe someone had told him that he should be a bit more like Joyce in that he, you know, sullen and sort of not seen. Mm-hmm. And the critique was, if you're supposed to be writing, like, why are you around hanging with celebrities all the time or on vacations all the time? The whole life of a writer then was very mysterious. Like, you would just sort of appear when you had your book
right.
that was released and you were promoting it, and maybe you'd be at a few parties, but otherwise you were largely absent because you were off writing. And that, I feel, has sort of changed so much in terms of even a lot of people who are very successful writers now. You sort of just have to do more to keep your name out there.
Yeah, constant visibility is a part of it. Yeah, right. Yeah. It just is the way things are. I would say the writers I'm most interested in are both compulsively introverted and compulsively extroverted. There are just two distinct hemispheres of their personality that they indulge, and that usually means we see a lot of them on social media.
Yeah. The last thing I want to say about Truman Capote, though, there's an episode where he hangs out with James Baldwin.
Oh, and right.
You want to talk about Julia. And complete fabrications.
Oh, completely. Yes, it's fully Mary Queen of Scots, that movie with Saoirse Ronan, where she and Elizabeth II mix it up in like a laundry tunnel where they like do a little Paso Doble and intimidate each other. It's fucking crazy.
Truman Capote did not even like James Baldwin's writing, by the way. He thought his fiction was boring. He said this in a letter in one of the, there's a collection of Capote's letters, and he trashes Baldwin's writing as boring, which, LOL. and the idea also that James Baldwin, who would have been living in Paris at the time because he hated the racism right. of America, would hop back to New York because the rich white women of New York City do not want to play with Truman Capote anymore.
Right.
He's going to come to Capote. I'm taking you to lunch, Truman. We need to get you out of the house.
It is a bit silly. It's a bit silly.
It's given the help.
Right. I mean, it's like, well, also, that's sort of in keeping with the other season of Feud about Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, where clearly some of it was fabricated to make the series a series, really, to make it long enough to sustain. Yeah.
But I would be really interested in a Capote-Baldwin series or play or something about them and their actual, you know, diametric
yeah.
viewpoints.
That'd be cute. That'd be cute. Yes. Probably going to happen, but honestly.
Also, one other thing about that. When they go to the museum and Capote's like, why didn't we ever date? We were circling each other. And I'm like, baby, James Baldwin was not swiping right on you.
First of all, it's actually, why did we never date? Could have had something.
Which isn't to say that Capote wasn't a cute girl, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like James Baldwin was a model, but he was pulling Marlon Brando, okay?
Right. Yeah, how long until Jesse Plemons wins an Oscar for playing Truman Capote? You know that's going down.
Yeah. He's got that, you know, that corn-fed look that Capote has.
And we're waiting for him to do the character actor thing and win that Oscar. It's all written in the stars. Anyway, we have to move on.
Yeah. All right, when we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis.
Yes.
What are you keeping this week?
Okay. So I haven't read this memoir yet. It's brand new, but RuPaul has a memoir out this week. And I'm seeing some, apparently the New York Times just wrote a very critical essay about it. But I will say this about RuPaul, who apparently hates doing interviews and says that at the beginning of this interview he does with Ronan Farrow in The New Yorker. But I love RuPaul interviews. To me, he does this thing that I think is so fascinating. You can never tell when you're going to get very realistic, rational, pragmatic, like, advice from RuPaul, or when he's going to swerve into full Marianne Williamson, angels are real, people are soul thieves territory. I love, you never know what you're going to get. And I just find it generally entertaining, as of course he is on the show. However, he also was commenting on Madonna, who of course is on tour right now. I'll be seeing her next week before the Oscars. She's a singer. And he said, in aging, there is a natural flow. And when you're against the flow, it doesn't look right. It doesn't feel right. The energy around the Madonna thing, it feels weird, right? Rue, and then he says, referring to her chasing arena tours and grills in her teeth. He adds, I'm not interested in appealing to 11 to 25 year olds. I'm just not. I can on a bigger level as a mother, as Mama Rue. It's a different relationship. I'm not trying to be them. It's always interesting when people revert to this line of criticism for Madonna, because I don't think she wants to be 11 or 25. I feel like she is constantly defining what it means to be an explosive, dance-oriented, pop-oriented star at her age. And I think that just means keeping doing what she's been doing. And also, when people say she's trying to appeal to a younger audience, are you sure she's not just appealing to her extremely longtime and committed fans? I just don't feel like she's somebody who needs to add more people. Something that worries me is I just feel like after a certain time, like, a lot of gay guys get to a point where conventional sexism ends up sounding like radical honesty to them. And I'm just disappointed to hear it from him, especially since if you watch RuPaul's Drag Race, no one is more reverent, generally speaking, to Madonna than RuPaul and also Michelle Visage. They had rusicles about Madonna. They've had drag runways where everybody comes in dressed as Madonna. We had that one time where four different people wore the kimono from the Nothing Really Matters video. So I'm just somewhat disappointed by that quote.
Mm. Now, you think longtime Madonna fans know what Fortnite is?
No, I'm right here. No, I have no idea.
Where the popular music video debuted.
Oh, yes. But, like, everybody does that shit now, right? Didn't Lady Gaga do something like that? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, she did a concert in that city. I think that's another... I think Fortnite's another place from Macbeth.
Right. No, I certainly will never find out what it is. I've already forgotten that you said it.
I mean, listen. I know what it's like when people shake the Vertel's nest, you know? and bring up your girl.
Right.
Does she even still wear the grill?
It's hard to tell. Like, by the way, this is the thing. People who've known who Madonna is for years and years and years, these are the people who should have the awesome criticisms of her. In fact, that's the whole kind of fun of being a Madonna fan, is you get to be continuously critical of her. I hate how garbled her voice sounds. I mean, like, when she speaks, you know, it doesn't remind me of her when I'm listening to an interview or something like that. If that is a grill situation, I mean, that's what's bothersome about it. But, and also the grill era has been, I think, at least a decade now, which nobody predicted.
Yeah. I hate that she brought Life and Beth out on the stage. Okay.
Oh, yeah. You mean Amy Schumer?
Yes. Yeah. I don't say their name.
Got it.
Say it too many times.
And... Right. You get a $30 million Netflix special. Ira, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it this week goes to nerds.
Oh, sure.
Male nerds online who are pretending that Zendaya is not one of our great young acting talents.
What are they saying?
Because they don't like her in Dune. Because they hate women in their sci-fi movies. Truly, after Dune was released, there was an onslaught of people questioning whether Zendaya is actually a good actress. And you know what? I'm just going to adjust my bang here. put on my glasses and read a little. Zendaya? Casey Undercover, Zendaya, Shake It Up, Zendaya, Emmy winning for Euphoria, Zendaya.
Twice.
Malcolm and Marie, which we do not discuss,
right.
Zendaya.
Surprised you even brought it up, yes.
And we cannot be living in a world where you are pretending that Zendaya cannot act. And you know what? maybe it's good because she's been going, you know, sort of rapidly for a long time without any sort of backlash, which not like you should want that as an actor, but, you know, it's nice for people to act silly about you for a minute just so other people can defend you.
Precisely.
And then we can move on from the conversation, you know, but I think it's just nonsense to pretend that Zendaya cannot act.
No, I mean, like, we were basically waiting for years for like the right thing to click into place so that this mega talent just had a place to exist. If anything, the craziest thing about Zendaya is that she lost Dancing with the Stars. That was one time, first of all, a universe she was in, and two, didn't like, you know, Nicole Scherzinger the fuck out of that competition.
Mm-hmm. If anything, I'm waiting to see what else she can do. I'm looking forward to Challengers, which looks like it's going to be a really good physical role for her. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've seen much physical acting from Zendaya. And in terms of Dune, I mean, listen, when you're in a Denis film, like we were discussing last week, he doesn't really care about actors.
No, he doesn't like the dialogue, darling. He wants to see the big cloudy sky. He's like, is the apocalypse coming? Let's film that.
He is that bucket from Adobe Photoshop, okay? He's just going around clipping in his scenes and the actors are, oh, you're there. You know, right. It's very Hitchcock. The actor doesn't exist without the light.
Right, right, right. They're cattle to him. Yes, as Hitchcock used to say.
But honestly, I'm still waiting for a moment for her to show these bitches even more, you know? I don't think we've really, aside from Euphoria, had even the definitive Zendaya role.
Also, by the way, because I would love another single from her because Replay is one of the top 2010s tracks. I love that song.
I remember I asked her once about music and I said, girl, when are we going to get more music? And she was like, not you too.
Hilarity from Zendaya? All right. Yeah.
When she used to be on Twitter more, I feel like her fans used to constantly tweet at her, when's the album coming? When's an album coming? And this was maybe like early Euphoria days when it still seemed like she was, and around Greatest Showman too, when it still seemed like releasing an album and being a pop star was a thing that was on this girl's mind.
Right, right, right.
You know? Now, fair question. I would be shocked if she released another album ever, you know? But never say never. She is a very young celebrity and, you know, many female celebrities, years into their career, who've never made music before, decide to drop albums.
There's a new Kate Hudson single out this week. And yet it's an old Kathy Lee Gifford album. I don't know how she did that.
Anyway, I've talked about Zendaya enough. So thank you to our guest, Tom Hollander, for joining us. And we will see you next week on Keep It. Don't forget to follow Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. You can also subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Chris Lord. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, Louis Vertel, and Kendra James. Our digital team is Megan Patzel, Claudia Shang, and Rachel Gajewski. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to Matt DeGroot, David Tolles, Kyle Seglin, and Charlotte Landis for production support every week.
On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic raised bed and garden soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.
Wayfair's biggest sale of the year is back. Get ready for Wayday. For 3 days only, May 4th through May 6th, you can get up to 80% off at Wayfair. Save on sofas and cookware, dining sets and rugs and beds, wall art, bar carts, floor lamps, ceiling fans, home decor, all things outdoor, and way more. Plus, everything ships free. Don't miss the sale to get up to 80% off everything home, even a garden gnome. Wayday starts May 4th. Head to wayfair.com now to start filling your cart.
Every style, every home.